welcome to Vicom's weekly Huddy Yun podcast. Delighted to have with us Caleb Ben-Dor and Richard Payton in Israel. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
So this is the last podcast of 2018. This is episode 33, and we have a very special discussion today, which is going to focus entirely on the publication of Vicom's annual forecast document called The Middle East in 2019. Some of our regular readers and listeners will know that every year we publish a paper which attempts to do the impossible, to predict the unpredictable, and try and project what the major events will be in the Middle East in the year ahead. And Caleb Ben-Dor, who is the lead author on this paper, has been holding discussions with the Vicom team and others, diplomats, security officials from a number of countries, to try and hone it down into a series of firm predictions and to decide what will happen next year. And Caleb, you've enjoyed the process, haven't you?
Very much so.
And I know you love prediction and coming up with very, very firm ideas of what's going to happen in the year ahead. And our listeners and readers will be amused to know that there is a long process of discussions that take place in the Vicom team where we go backwards and forwards about things that we think will happen or won't happen and how much we really want to predict. And last year, we got a few right and a few wrong. But one of the major ones that we got right last year was that there would be a direct confrontation militarily between Iran and Israel in Syria, which happened over a period of months, but most notably in May, when missiles were fired by Iran into Israel. We also predicted that Turkey would invade northern Syria. And we correctly predicted that the US would leave the Iran nuclear deal. So for this year, I think we should start off by talking about Iran and Syria and Iran and Hezbollah. And you set out, Caleb, in the document that you think that, I suppose, the sort of battle between Israel and Iran in Syria is kind of ended in a way, and you could say that maybe Israel won that round, that it's been successful in destroying Iranian military bases in Syria and stopping arms shipments to Hezbollah from Syria. And so therefore your view is that 2019 is really going to be about Iran trying a new tactic where it will be actually trying to equip Hezbollah's missile arsenal in Lebanon with precision guidance systems. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I think that's very true. In many ways, Israel did win the clash of strategic logics in Syria between Israel and Iran. And in fact, part of that was actually the downing of the Russian plane, which in many ways was a disaster, but I think it also caused Russia to try and calm what was going on over the skies in Syria. So I think they said to the Israelis, you've got to cut it out, but they also said to the Iranians, stop doing all of this in Syria. And what that led to was Iran trying to move the focus of its operations from Syria, where Israel can strike quite easily, into Lebanon, where it's significantly harder to bomb and to fly over. And I think one of the biggest dilemmas in 2019 for Israeli decision makers is going to be what to do about these factories that are creating technology to put on Hezbollah missiles that can create very accurate missiles that, when they're fired, will land within, I think, maybe 50 meters of their location. Hezbollah does not have many of these currently. In fact, PM Netanyahu today said they only have a few dozen. But this is something that is ongoing to try and significantly upgrade their arsenal. And it puts Israeli decision makers in a very difficult position. Either they preemptively strike against these factories, which could lead to a serious escalation, or they allow them to build, and then think when rather than if, when there is another war between Israel and Hezbollah will have this far greater and more serious military capacity. So that's really the dilemma that Israeli decision makers are facing.
So it's basically like you nip it in the bud and potentially risk an all-out war now, but a war where the terms are actually maybe slightly more favourable to Israel because these missiles don't have guidance systems, or you wait until you have a much clearer set of targets, albeit a much more extensive arsenal that could cause devastating consequences in Israel. So it's a really terrible dilemma. But in terms of timescale, I mean, if the Prime Minister of Israel is saying they have a few dozen such missiles at the moment, how long until they have a few hundred?
Well, we know there were three factories that were active near the airport that Netanyahu talked about in the UN General Assembly in September. He's now said that those were closed. We know that there was one along the border with Syria and Lebanon, which was bombed a few weeks ago. There was even, what reports suggest is when the Russian plane was downed, the Israeli attack on Latakia was also on this type of factory. So what we don't know is if the factories are up and running, how long these things will take to kind of upgrade the missiles. I'll just add one other thing. There's a medium option in between this preemptive strike or wait, and that is trying to convince the international community that it really needs to be dealt with. And I think currently Israel is trying that option. I think it's leveraging what happened with the tunnels to really shine a spotlight on what Hezbollah are doing. The question will be, what kind of will or capacity does the international community have to really prevent this sort of thing happening? We heard that Russia were kind of on side with telling Lebanon to rein in Hezbollah, but to rely on the international community for this sort of issue is generally not had high success. So Israel could find itself very much facing this serious dilemma.
I was going to add that although we are talking about the threat from Lebanon, which has kind of become more acute, I don't think we should dismiss and diminish kind of the ongoing tension on Syrian territory as well. Certainly the idea that we've spoken about in the past of the land corridor, and also we've seen this intelligence tracking of aircraft that are still going in and to smuggle weapons in and to use Syria as a halfway house to get those weapons into Hezbollah hands. The other piece that the paper talks about is the new kind of reconciliation that we'll have to deal with. Israel will have to deal with the placing of the S-300 anti-aircraft missile defense system, potentially operated by Russian forces within Syria, that may affect Israel's maneuverability within that area.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Just panning out a little bit and talking about Iran's wider problem. I mean, our conclusion from the report is that Iran is going to suffer severely from sanctions, but it won't leave the JCPOA nuclear deal, but it won't negotiate with the US. So it's going to have a very difficult time domestically, economically. But essentially, your view, Caleb, was that they're just going to try and wait out the Trump administration. That's your view.
Yeah, the Iranians received a huge amount of money after the JCPOA was signed. They've got quite large reserves. They were selling around 2.5 million barrels a day of oil before the sanctions hit. It's now around 1.5 million. It's difficult to know because there's a lot of black market stuff, but they do have reserves. I'd be very surprised if they seek to renegotiate the deal, especially as from an Iranian perspective, and they could be right, they believe what the US wants is regime change. So if that's what the US wants, the Iranians aren't going to try and renegotiate the deal. And if they break out of the deal, they will kind of lose the Europeans. And also the deal gives them a lot of things. The deal gives them the legitimacy to be a threshold nuclear state when the deal sunsets. So the JCPOA does give them a lot. I think what's most likely is they will try and wait out Trump. So try and wait out till the end of 2020. The real question will be, and I'm sure we'll discuss this in future podcasts, if Trump wins re-election and there's another 4 years of a Trump administration, then perhaps the considerations of the Iranian regime change. But I think for now, the aim is to sit tight and to try and see out Trump and then to see what happens after that.
Yeah, very interesting. Let's move on and just talk about the situation in Israel. There's a very interesting set of circumstances of I suppose three different issues kind of moving around on the Israeli elections that we know will definitely take place, we think, in May or June. And then connected to that, whether there'll be a US peace plan and whether the Attorney General in Israel will indict Prime Minister Netanyahu on charges of corruption. So should we deal first with the US peace plan? I mean, my view, I can't see this peace plan being published, although I have spoken to US sources that say, you know, the Trump administration is very adamant they want to do it, that they don't mind about the impact on the Israeli domestic political scene, that their priority is to publish it. And they realize that if they don't publish it now, then it could wait until after the Israeli elections. And that will really push it and any activity around it into a presidential election year, which would be very, very problematic. I just want to know what your views are. Published, not published, when might it happen, will it never happen?
Well, I think we saw some recent revelations actually yesterday, according to American sources, that said this was really, they took a real blow in the context of Khashoggi murder, that the role of the Saudi Arabians were playing. It's kind of brokers behind the scenes with a kind of bringing in buy-in from the Arab world was a very important kind of factor in the Americans' consideration. And that's taken a recent blow, which I think is more evidence to suggest, as you were saying, that it's going to be pushed off into the longer grass, that if they don't have the buy-in from crucial stakeholders within the Sunni world, and we already know what the Palestinians are saying about it, then I think it's going to be very difficult to deliver. So it may work in their advantage to wait. And as you kind of insinuate, may not happen at all.
I think just to follow up on that, the question would, firstly, you're speaking to someone who is consistently wrong on predicting what the Trump administration does. That's kind of the first thing by means of introduction. I think the question would be, on the assumption, this is also in the forecast paper, that if it were to be published, it will more or less be dead on arrival. As in, the Palestinians have boycotted the administration. As Richard said, the Arab voice has taken a big blow with the undermining of Saudi Arabia. The Europeans are already setting themselves up to reject it. And something that I don't think we speak about enough is that the current Israeli government will almost certainly have big issues also with the plan. So in light of all of that, the question really would be, what is better? To kick it into the long grass and say it needs to be postponed, or to publish it and for it to be dead on arrival? Neither are great options, but James, I think you're right in terms of the window. 2020 is far from ideal. Just before an Israeli election is far from ideal. I think if the elections were going to take place in November, then the administration would put it on the table in the coming months. But if it's going to be May, June, and a future government is only going to be sworn in August, then there is potentially a window of August till the end of 2019. But I could quite easily see, and in fact, we say in the forecasting that we don't believe that it's ultimately going to be published.
Yeah. And then linked to that is this issue of the timing of the Israeli election. And we thought, like many people, that there might be an election this year. Indeed, we said that in our paper last year. Didn't happen, although it almost happened. We're looking now at an election being called in February, March, and that taking place because of the Israeli campaign period lasting all that very long period of 3 months, that the election would be in May or June. So really, I suppose the question is, what happens with the Attorney General and his indictment? And my view, which I know you disagree with, is I can't see him publishing it before the election because he's got so much potentially still to do, to review all this paperwork, etc. They said it will be in the first quarter of 2019, but if the election is called in February or March, then he may not have finished it by then. But I know you've got a slightly different view, Kalle.
Well, in the paper, we talk about four things that could influence the election. The first, which we've touched on, is the Trump peace plan. We don't know if it's going to be published or not, but that if it were to be, that would shape the election period. The second one is the security situation. Netanyahu has for many years described himself as Mr. Security. A lot of the Israeli public but buy into that. But there are serious situations in Gaza. There are increasingly serious situations on the West Bank. And he's now the defense minister. So he has complete responsibility for all of this. And another issue that will shape the elections is what's going on the ground. A third thing we said was whether a charismatic character will come in from the outside, or someone who will be able to unite the left or the centre-left, someone like, for example, Benny Gantz, the former chief of staff, and how that might affect things. And the fourth component is an indictment. Again, what people say here is that Mandelblit will make a recommendation in March, April time, or the first quarter of the year. To me, what's interesting is we don't even know how that will affect voting patterns. As in, after the police made their recommendations, Likud actually went up in popularity. So my feeling is there will be a decision before the elections, and I think the opposition and others will demand that the public go into the election knowing what Netanyahu is accused of. But it's not necessarily clear that a significant indictment on bribery, fraud and breach of trust would necessarily undermine Netanyahu's numbers in the polls.
Well, I mean, it may not undermine his numbers in the polls, but surely his opponents then use that as a way to shift alliances. And can you not see a situation where, you know, once he's vulnerable, once there's a possibility in the future that he may end up having to do a plea bargain to avoid prison, that Likud rivals will try and outmaneuver him, that there will be parties that might try and take the opportunity to be the first to say they wouldn't serve in a coalition, etc. I mean, it will definitely transform the existing alliances in Israeli politics, because a Prime Minister Netanyahu who may be indicted is definitely a very different proposition to someone who the Attorney General has said should be indicted.
I was just going to add, I mean, I share your view, James, that I think the Attorney General has shown us until now that he's in no hurry at all to publish the recommendations, and so seem to think that it will be longer. I think, but I'm not sure I agree with your last comment that will be the changer. Certainly within the existing coalition partners, I don't think that most of them, the quote unquote, the natural allies of Netanyahu. There's a lot being made of in the last few weeks with the fragility of the government, about not bringing down a right-wing government, and a lot of that would be echoed again in the same context that if the Prime Minister Netanyahu goes into the campaign as the leading candidate of the right wing, as a candidate for Prime Minister, that you don't diminish that power, you don't break the block by ruling him out. And so I don't think they'll have those same scruples that perhaps parties on the centre and the centre left will be more comfortable to say anyone but Netanyahu, so to speak.
Right, understood. Okay, so moving on slightly, I think we should just talk a little bit about what we think is happening with ISIS. And you know, Caleb, you say in the paper that you think that there's going to be a real reemergence of ISIS, particularly in Iraq. I mean, we've seen reports over the last few months that there's a perception that ISIS has gone away, it's lost lots of territory, but we've seen reports that ISIS is regrouped as an insurgency, that it's been very successful in kind of disappearing into the shadows. You know, the fighters are kind of everywhere and nowhere. You know, they're not holding territory, they're not in fixed positions, but they're able to quite stealthily carry out bombing attacks, shooting attacks, hundreds and hundreds of those taking place in Iraq, causing really serious problems. And really, you know, your view is that this is going to get worse in the year ahead.
Well, I mean, the report is based on US intelligence officials who basically said that although the classic understanding is that ISIS has been more or less territorially defeated, there still are several thousand fighters. For me, it's amazing to think about. There's still 100 new foreign fighters who are joining ISIS each month. And so I think the US is, I mean, this touches on something else. We've just seen reports that the US might be leaving parts of Syria. And then the question would be, if they're so worried about ISIS, why would they be leaving? Maybe we can expand that further. But there is within certain areas of the US security, this fear that ISIS is not done and dusted. They've still got a lot of fighters. And the other thing we talk about is that ISIS remains a huge terror threat in the UK and Europe, in terms of both in terms of returning fighters, but also people who have been radicalized but didn't make it out to Syria, so they remain in their homes in the UK, and they also pose a large threat.
Yeah, absolutely. So just moving on slightly from ISIS, I mean, we touched on it before about Mohammed bin Salman and his purported role in any Israeli-Palestinian peace process. I mean, the big story this year, and this will intensify next year, is really the collapse of the reputation of Mohammed bin Salman. I mean, he started the year with, you know, many people writing breathless profiles of this young prince who wanted to modernize his kingdom and had all these ideas about, you know, building new industrial modern cities. And he was bringing in new measures so that, you know, women in Saudi Arabia could drive. And there was the cinemas opening. And then, you know, with the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, basically that has all been destroyed. And his role in any peace talks is really, you know, going to have to disappear. His modernization agenda is in doubt. Economically, the investments are not coming. And there was an announcement, I think, just today that they are really going to have to, you know, draw on their reserves and increase spending to try and stimulate the economy, which is not where they want to be at all. And they're still suffering, like many of the oil-producing countries, from the historic decrease in oil revenue. I mean, this has really been the year where Mohammed bin Salman kind of rose and fell quite dramatically, and that has implications across the region, doesn't it?
It's been very dramatic. I mean, I guess it began. We had his decision to enter the war in Yemen. There was a decision to try and boycott Qatar. There was the kind of coerced resignation of Hariri in Lebanon. Those are all things that actually happened over a year ago. But the Khashoggi thing has really been very, very significant in terms of how he's perceived. In the West, in inverted open brackets, apart from by the Trump administration. But I think the other really significant thing is that this is the first time, if he becomes king, this will be the first time that the crown has been passed from father to son rather than from brother to brother. And so you have a situation where the next king of Saudi Arabia could be there for a good 40 years. And I think a lot of hope was pinned on MBS as this modernizer, but a lot of decisions he's made have been severely questioned. And I think in terms of an Israeli-Palestinian perspective, the hope was that MBS could basically bring the Arab voice together, and they could go to Abbas and they could more or less coerce him to say yes, and then all of that could be brought to Israel. But that whole outside-in idea, the fact you can get the Arab states on board and then they'll bring the Palestinians, I think has collapsed. I'll just say one other thing, which is a completely contradictory argument, which is because MBS's star is now so low and he needs something very significant to get back in everyone's good books, there is an argument, which I think is unlikely, but there is an argument that he will have some sort of public meeting with Netanyahu or with another Israeli to basically get on everyone's good side again. I don't think it's likely, although it is possible. Another option is he could be the big peacemaker in Yemen in 2019. So there is this argument that MBS needs to do something very significant to restore some of the confidence people had in him. But yes, you're right, 2019 was a disastrous year for him.
So let's just conclude on the Palestinians. And we've talked a lot on this podcast about Gaza. And I think nothing has changed really in the last few weeks on Gaza, in that we have a sort of shaky cessation of hostilities between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. We have a stabilization agreement between Israel and Hamas that will probably never be signed because of the issues around that with Palestinian reconciliation, Hamas refusing to disarm, prisoner swaps, etc. But the really interesting development over the last few weeks that we also talk about is that there has been a real increase in violent shooting attacks in the West Bank against Israelis, and that shows a wider trend that Hamas has been working very hard to carry out terrorist attacks in the West Bank against Israelis. And there was a very stark figure from the Israeli security services that they stopped 400 attacks in 2017, but they stopped 580 in 2018, which is a very significant increase, and they've seen a very significant increase in Hamas cells that they have arrested. So there's a real push there, isn't there, from Hamas to carry out more attacks in the West Bank, and we expect to see more of that, don't we, in the year ahead?
Well, I think as you've said, the motivation of Hamas to bring these attacks to bear in the West Bank has been there in the hundreds over the last 2 or 3 years. There is actually within the Israeli political security establishment, there's a lot of criticism over the most recent shooting attack last week in Givat Asaf, that the troops really weren't on a high enough alert as they should be, and kind of operational mishaps there, because that's just an example of the old adage that they only need to get lucky once, whilst the security establishment needs to get it right every time to prevent these attacks. Netanyahu said last week that, you know, it can't be the case where they've reached a sort of understanding over in Gaza, but they're reshifting their focus to violence in the West Bank. And I think the other question to come in 2019 will be, we've seen two deliveries of these suitcases of cash from the Qataris. We're due to see four more in the next few months, but then the question mark, what then in terms of long-term rehabilitation for the Gaza Strip? So both within Gaza and within West Bank, I think we're in for a period of prolonged tension that one can only hope from the Israeli perspective that the security establishment are as alert and able to prevent as many attacks as are planned.
And then final point, while we mentioned it, I mean, Hamas is clearly trying to undermine the Palestinian Authority. We had a poll this morning that said that in an election between Hamas and the PA, between Haniya and Abbas, Hamas would win, showing the increasing popularity of Hamas in the West Bank. But really, the situation with the Palestinian leadership has not changed for the last few years, or even for longer than that. I mean, Abbas is still there. People are saying he can't go on forever. If he were to depart the scene, there would be extreme destabilization among the Palestinian leadership, new leaders with legitimacy deficits that might seek a more extreme position vis-a-vis Israel. But really, nothing is changing for now. Do you agree, gentlemen?
I think the succession crisis, which we don't know when it will happen, but we know it will happen at some stage, whether in 2019 or afterwards, is really going to be a significant challenge for everyone involved, for the Palestinians, for the PA, certainly for Israel, for the international community. Abbas holds three titles. He's chairman of the PLO, he's head of Fatah, and he's also president of the Palestinian Authority. And it's unclear whether anyone who replaces him will be able to hold all of those, or whether it will be divided up. I think the fear in Israel is that Abbas, despite what people perceive as his many faults, is committed to negotiations over violent resistance, and is also very committed to security coordination with Israel, despite it being increasingly unpopular on the Palestinian street. And I think the fear is that whoever, whether it's one person or three, takes over from him, those both of those things will be under question, and that's a big fear, I think, in Israel, as well as a serious threat of instability on the ground. And I think Hamas, which long-term plan is to lead the Palestinian National Movement, is also waiting for an after Abbas situation. And all of these things put together create a large amount of instability.
Well, that's all we've got time for. Thank you so much, gentlemen. And we will reconvene in the new year with episode 34. But to all our listeners and readers, we wish you a very happy festive season and a very happy new year. And with your time off there, please feel free to rate and to review our podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And we will see you in the new year.